he just did something that made me laugh so hard, and I thought, God, that guy is so funny. Wait a minute. Is he sexy and cute?
That's Megan Mullally talking about her husband, Nick Offerman. They call their love story the greatest love story ever told. We'll hear why later in the show. Because Happy New Year! Our gift to you is a re-listen of some of our favorite interviews from 2018. First up, actor Lakeith Stanfield. He starred in the critically acclaimed absurdist dark comedy Sorry to Bother You last year. The film is set in an alternative present in Oakland. And it's kind of a fantasy about what might happen if our Darwinian economy goes on unchecked. There are winners and losers, and the losers end up in a place called worry-free. All their needs are taken care of, but they have to work forever for free. The lead character is a black guy named Cash who's down on his luck. He gets a job as a telemarketer, and the cash starts flowing when he learns how to use a white voice.
As always, we'll be getting that out to you right away.
He's so good at using his white voice and getting sales that he's promoted.
We just got the call. They think you're A1 material. You're going upstairs, my compadre.
And then he becomes part of the elite class. His activist friends are protesting. Things get even weirder from there. Cash is played by actor Lakeith Stanfield. You may know him as Darius from the FX show Atlanta. He was also in the films Get Out and Straight Outta Compton and Crown Heights. Lakeith Stanfield joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks.
You have a long resume for just a short time. I mean, you're 26 years old.
Yeah. That was a very flattering intro. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, it's all true.
Yeah.
So tell us about how this film came to you.
This film came to me, I was at Sundance a couple years back, and I ran into this man who had a really big afro. And he had some interesting clothes on and some really big boots. And I was like, who is this guy? And why is he following me around? And it turned out to be Boots Riley. And he had a script in his back pocket. And he'd pull it out and be like, I got this thing. And I think it might be interesting to talk about. And so after a while of just procrastinating, as I sometimes do, I began to look into his script. And once I did, I saw this story, Sorry to Bother You. And the first time I read it, I had no idea what it was, and I thought it was quite crazy. And so I just was like, whatever, let's move on to the next project. And then I went back and revisited, and I was like, I have to do this. I have to be a part of this movie because I've never read anything like this before.
So what changed between the first time when you were like, nah, I got to do something else, to I have to do this?
I think sometimes when you initially read a script, you kind of just give a once-over and you kind of just pick up on a couple key things and you're like, nah, 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 nah. But I think when you go back, so this is why I always try to read them more than once. When you go back and read it a second or third time, you really start to hone in and focus on the details of what's going on and really track and follow the story in a different way, at least I do. And so the second time, I really kind of understood what he was doing. And I was like, oh, okay, this is crazy. Like, all right. I'm in.
Yeah.
Like, totally, yeah.
Was what attracted you the political message as one thing that really made you say, wow, this is
The journey of Cash is coming from not having much and trying to earn his keep in the world and find himself in the world. And in the midst of that, an internal conflict with himself and who he had become, I thought was an interesting thing and something that I felt that to an extent I was going through at the same time. So I felt that could be interesting to explore. The ideas about how it applied socially on a larger scale were just like icing on the cake.
Mm. Well, talk about that, how you related to the character, because you grew up in Victorville, right?
Mm.
And so now you're a star, you're a celebrity, right? Do you get recognized now?
Yeah.
So that's quite a difference from where you grew up.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah, things are changing as far as the visibility and things are concerned. And just my whole lifestyle has kind of had to change. And everything has just been shifting this past couple years quite rapidly. So I've gotten the feeling of similar to like Paperboy in Atlanta, just the feeling of how the world is changing around me. And Cassius is a similar journey when he starts to become successful at the job as a telemarketer that he's working at. So I kind of saw that parallel there, and I was like, this would be something that I want to explore within myself. And so I wanted to do that with Cassius.
Mm-hmm. So he literally has a white voice in the movie.
Yeah.
And obviously that's a metaphor, right? So I guess I'm wondering in your own life if you've had to put on a white voice.
I'm speaking English. No, I mean,
metaphorically.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to some extent, I guess anyone that's ever had to, you know, hold a position or a job where they've had to assume some other type of role in order to do what they had to do is, and to some extent, assuming the quote-unquote white voice, because it's necessary for our survival. We've always had to act. And to an extent, that's just an act to bring about, you know, the results that you want, which is to move forward in your career, whatever it might be.
Yeah. So when you first came here, how did you envision your career? What were your goals as an actor when you first came here from Victorville?
To act.
Did you have a goal in mind, like what you wanted to do?
No, I just wanted to work, and any opportunity I got, I just wanted to take a hold and hopefully from there begin to build something else. But my main preoccupation was just like, I just want to be on a set. So I'm auditioning and trying to secure anything I can do. And, you know, so yeah, I was very hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Quite like Cassius in the beginning of the movie.
Right. So he, in the movie, he's desperate for a job because he lives in his uncle's garage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really funny scene at the beginning where he's fooling around with his girlfriend. Somehow the garage door opens and there's everyone's walking down the street. Oh, that's just into his life.
Thought you said you fixed that.
My landlord was supposed to fix it.
And he drives this really sad car. And so he's desperate for a job, but it also appears that he's desperate for meaning. Finding something that means something to him.
Mm-hmm.
Why does being a telemarketer fulfill that need for him?
I think it gives him a sense of purpose and belonging, and it also makes him feel like he's good at something. And I think for the majority of Cassius's life, he didn't know what he was good at and couldn't find what he was good at, and kind of felt aimless in the world. And I think this provided him with an opportunity to say, well, I attach my meaning to this thing I'm really good at, and it yields results as well. And now I can actually live better because I'm getting better at it. And I think that's what it gave him, a sense of purpose and sort of direction.
In the sense that his value also would be tied up with material success as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was driving a rinky-dink car, and all of a sudden it became a really nice car, and he was in the garage, and it became a nicer garage.
A nicer garage. A much nicer garage.
Yeah, with many floors.
Like a penthouse.
Yeah.
So, at nice suits, and then he gets invited to these parties, and then he has to decide whether or not he's going to cross a picket line that his friends are protesting in.
Mm-hmm.
And then he makes the decision to do that.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a common conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had that question as you've been choosing roles or deciding what to play, deciding what your career would be?
Definitely, because, you know, earlier I stated when I first came, I was attempting just to find work, and that's all it was. And as my career began to develop, then I saw that there was opportunity to try and tailor the work that I was doing in order to grow from it and learn from it and feel from it and become a fuller human being. It became an extension of my life after a while. And so I wanted the work that I was doing to reflect the different journeys and paths that I was taking in life, because it also worked hand in hand, because if what I was doing mirrored what I was living, then it was better work. The work that I was doing that didn't mirror that was just like, I'm just kind of dancing in the balance. But I wanted to have meaning, like Cassius. And so I wanted to take these life lessons that I was learning and kind of weave them into my work. And so that meant that now I had to maybe sometimes not always take the money and sometimes take the things that meant more. Actually, Sorry to Bother You was one of those things. We made this on very little means, but it was something that I really, really believed in and that everyone that I was around believed in. And it turned out to be great.
Yeah. What about Atlanta when you got the role of Darius?
Yeah, young Darius. That was another one that was really challenging for me at first, because I didn't understand it. I didn't get Darius, and I just thought he was kind of like this dopey, like uninspired character that didn't move me one way or the other until I came back and revisited about a third time. And then I was like, okay, so there could be something here to explore.
Because I think he has developed. In the first season, he was just the comic relief, really.
Mm-hmm.
And now in the second season, he's become kind of a way more interesting character.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he was a comic relief in the first season, but there were still, I think, implications that could be made about certain things he would say. Just a little tidbit thing just to make you think about, like, if I really take that and unpack that, what does that mean? And we explored more of that in the second season. But, yeah, he's just a really interesting character that has a lot of exploration that still needs to take place.
Have you ever had an encounter like you did with Teddy Perkins?
Yeah, the encounter that I had with Teddy Perkins was that exact thing, because I didn't know who that was. It was just I showed up and this strange man was here, and I was like, who the hell is this guy?
You didn't know it was Donald Glover?
No.
You're kidding, when you were filming?
Yeah, no, for the first couple scenes, I just didn't know who the hell this person was. And it was really kind of creepy. Like, I really don't know who this man is. Like, it's not like a...
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you found out, how did you find out, first of all?
I found out much later, a little birdie. I was asking everyone on set. I was like, who's this guy? Who's this guy? And someone said, boo-boo. And I was like, oh. And my mind was blown. I was like, what? Like, I was looking in this guy's eyes. That's not... And I still don't quite believe it.
So when the director would yell cut and you guys stopped filming, he wouldn't be out of character? He wouldn't say, hey...
No. The only person I saw the entire time filming Teddy Perkins was Teddy Perkins.
And how long did that go on?
The duration of the whole filming of the episode. And then Teddy disappeared and I never saw him again.
So you're still not entirely convinced it was Donald Glover?
I'm not. I will not. I cannot be tricked in this way.
That kind of blows my mind. It makes me rethink that episode now. I need to go back and watch it.
Yeah, it definitely blew my mind. The time stopped for a little while. I was like, oh.
So wait, was anyone else fooled, or was everybody in on it except for
everyone
you?
Everyone was in on it except for
you.
You
were the only one.
Yeah. So they were just, they just cleverly thought out this thing and told everyone, just like, play along.
Because he wanted to get your authentic reaction. Like,
that might have been why. I'm not sure. Maybe they just wanted to play
just
a joke.
Just I was going to say. So it seems that you do enjoy playing characters in surreal situations. And the character that you played in Get Out, there seems to be a similarity to the character you're playing in this movie, where you have to channel your white voice with both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because the character in Get Out, he's a white guy trapped in a dead black man's body, like a ghost kind of thing.
Yeah, like a zombie.
Yeah. I mean, did you think about that when you were filming this movie, like the parallels?
No. It was kind of a completely different story, I think. I don't know. This is not like the taking over of a body as much as it is assuming. So, like, the white voice represents not really, like, a white person's voice, but more like a perception and disposition an idea.
You want to make some money here? Then read the script with a white voice.
When people say I talk with a white voice anyway, so why ain't it helping me out?
Well, you don't talk white enough. I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. I'm talking about the real deal, like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Just more of a comfortability and just feeling at ease and knowing it's going to be all right. And that's a position that's not always afforded to people who aren't white all the time in this country. And not all white people, but more generally speaking. So it's more just a positioning thing than a actual becoming white, I guess.
Yeah. And so that the whole white voice is really about just knowing that you belong.
Exactly.
Like knowing... not questioning your presence.
Exactly.
Or the right to be there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
So I guess he's also saying that it's a swindle, right? I mean, the better you are at doing that, the better you can swindle other people.
Yeah. You can slide by undetected. No one's going to second guess because it's just the like, as you said, like the normal thing. It's just like that's the standard. So it makes, you know, it makes sense. Same thing with like standard English. Like if you're black in America, you know there's like two voices at least that you have, and there's one where you're kicking it with your homies and you're talking and it's like it's cool, like what's up, bro, you know. And then there's the one where you're in the interview and you must talk a certain way in order to secure the job. And that's just a thing, that kind of an unspoken thing that we all kind of understand that it's necessary. And it's referred to in this movie as the white voice.
I mean, it's interesting that it's set in Oakland, which you're probably too young to remember this, but there was a huge furor over Ebonics in Oakland. And the fact that they were teaching Ebonics in the public schools and everyone got freaked out about it. And
teaching Ebonics, you mean it was part of the curriculum?
To
learn how to speak in Ebonics?
Well, to sort of celebrate it kind of thing. And then, you know, people who are about, oh, well, America, we should speak in a certain way, were outraged.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I think it'd be quite nice to talk about Ebonics and explore that a little bit. Ain't nothing wrong with a little bit of Ebonics.
You have lots of voices.
I've been speaking to you in my radio voice the whole time.
Oh, you have?
I don't know if you've noticed this.
I have noticed. It's your public radio voice.
Yes.
On top of that. I guess we all have lots of different voices, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
That's Lakeith Stanfield. We spoke last summer about his movie, Sorry to Bother You. It's available now on Hulu. Coming up, my interview with director Matthew Heineman about his first feature film. It's called A Private War, and it stars Golden Globe nominee Rosamund Pike as journalist Marie Colvin. Colvin died reporting on the front lines of Syria. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What does it take to be a war correspondent? What kind of person is drawn to cover death and destruction? And crucially, does the reporting make any difference? All questions raised in the feature film A Private War. It stars Rosamund Pike as famed correspondent Marie Colvin.
I gotta go back. There are 28,000 people there. We can't abandon.
Listen to me! You're brilliant. I'm brave, and you've got an amazing nose for the story. But you don't have a military brain, all right?
Let me go.
Hey, we will die if we go back, okay? We will
go back.
Die.
Hugo.
No.
Save me a seat at the bar.
Yeah, which bar?
Come on.
Where?
Ready?
That would be the moment before Colvin died, in Syria, from a bomb dropped by government forces back in 2012. Marie Colvin's the subject of a feature film, and Rosamund Pike is nominated for a Golden Globe for portraying her. A Private War is directed by Matthew Heineman. He's directed award-winning documentaries, Cartel Land and City of Ghosts. Let's listen back now to my conversation with him about A Private War. Well, let's talk a little bit more about her and that question about believing whether or not people would actually care about the story that she risked her life to get. And she really questions that a lot. What do you think she actually thought? Did she think it was, she must have thought it was worth it.
I think she did struggle with the idea of, you know, does the world care? You know, it's so easy to keep these conflicts at arm's length. It's so easy to sort of glance at a headline and think you understand something. And I think, you know, she felt, and that's why she continued to go to these places despite every blaring neon sign saying stop, 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 to go there to tell these stories that weren't being told and to humanize them and to create a sense of empathy with people around the world. That's what drove her, really, among many other things.
Let's just hear a clip of tape from her, actually from her. This is from your movie.
I cared enough to go to these places and write in some way, something that would make someone else care as much about it as I did at the time. Part of it is you're never going to get to where you're going if you acknowledge fear. I think fear comes later when it's all over.
So that moment that we heard earlier where she just goes to tell the story of those 28,000 people trapped in the city of Homs in Syria, I mean, we don't know, but I guess she didn't feel the immediate fear at the time. She just felt that urgent need to tell their story because nobody else was doing it. She was literally the only journalist who was covering that.
That was actually her going back into the city. She had already filed copy, you know, and the story was already out. And so she didn't need to go back. I think she really felt like, you know, no one was telling the story of these 28,000 people besieged in the city of Homs, and that she was outraged at the horrors of what was happening. And she went on Anderson Cooper and broadcast, and, you know, there's a lot of evidence that shows that that broadcast ultimately led to Assad targeting her and ultimately killing her and injuring Paul Conroy and killing another journalist, Remy Olchik.
Because of the signal that she was sending up when she was talking via satellite.
There's also evidence that she was actually being tracked all the way from Beirut. Her family has filed the lawsuit against the Assad regime that has a lot of evidence to show that she was deliberately targeted. You know, we've seen this playbook used throughout history of tyrannical regimes stifling information. And that's pretty clearly what was happening here. That's a big reason why I wanted to make this film, is that I think in this world of fake news, in this world where journalism is under attack, for me, the film is both an homage to Marie and all her brilliance and all her courage and all her complicated addictions, but also an homage to journalism, to people who are out there fighting for the truth. You know, my mom was a journalist. You know, I'm a documentary filmmaker. Or a journalist. I don't know what I am. But, you know, this is something that I care about deeply. And in my career, I've similarly tried to take subjects that I don't think people understand too well and try to humanize them and put a, you know, human face to them.
And in your movie Cartel Land, you took some risks there yourself. And I'm wondering if you understood that part of what drove Marie and what drives war correspondents is that adrenaline fuel rush that it feels, it's just like you feel alive or you feel you like the sense of adventure. Is that a similar feeling? Did you relate to that feeling?
Yeah, but I think the rush, I think for me and I think for her as well, the rush was not the adrenaline per se or like being on the front lines or getting shot at. I think it's more the rush of getting the story out that at least I felt compelled by. I was never, you know, wanting to be in a torture chamber or in a meth lab or in a shootout. It was, this is where the story was happening and this is where I had to go to tell it. But, it was quite strange, as it was for her, to then, you know, be in a shootout in the middle of the streets of Michoacan, Mexico, one day and then be in a party in New York City the next night. And that dichotomy is obviously something that we explore in this film, you know, these two worlds that she inhabited and the PTSD that she suffered after going for 2+ decades to the most dangerous places on Earth. You know, she, you know, was a larger-than-life character that lived an amazing life, but also she suffered. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was quite important to explore that.
Yeah. But you do question, or at least the movie does question, her, I guess, addiction to covering these war zones as, yes, this need, this incredible driving need to tell the story, but also that it was almost like a physical addiction, right? That she had to be there. And you're saying that's not necessarily because of the adrenaline, it's something else?
It's really hard to nail it down to one thing. I think she hated being in those places, really. You know, she hated being shot at. She had fear. But, you know, I think she felt compelled to bear witness to these stories and to these people. And I think as her life went on, you know, she suffered more and more from PTSD and alcoholism and other things. And, you know, all of these things swirled to cloud her judgment over time. She died when she was 56. And there were so many signs in those preceding years that she shouldn't be doing what she's doing, but she couldn't stop doing it.
And what was it about her journalism and the way she wrote that was so compelling? How did she tell stories differently and how did she make them come alive for people?
it was two things. It, you know, she really tried to avoid stats and numbers, which can be so numbing. And she told stories about, you know, people. She told stories about lovers. She told stories about children and mothers and fathers, and always colored her stories with details of, you know, a shoe or a necklace or an earring, just in a way to help people empathize that they're just like you and me, but in an extremely different place.
And she worked for the Sunday Times of London, even though she's American, much better known in Europe than she was here in the United States. And of course, she was famous in the journalism world, especially the foreign correspondent world, not only for her writing and for her taking on these stories, these incredibly dangerous stories, but also for her look. Like, she wore this black eye patch because she lost an eye covering the war in Sri Lanka. And she was also very glamorous and just kind of seemed larger than life. Had you known much about her before you started working on this project?
I knew of her. I didn't know her personally. I would have loved to meet her and to know her. And after I came on board to the film, and then also after I cast Rosamund Pike to play her, we sort of went from friend to friend, colleague to colleague, and gained their trust and learned about her and studied her and examined her. And, you know, it was a really emotional film to make. I cast mainly non-actors, refugees, Libya and Jordan, where we shot, to play the background cast, so that when Rosamund walks into what's called the widow's basement, a basement filled with women and children in the besieged city of Homs, you know, the women that she spoke to were real women from Homs telling their real stories, shedding real tears. You know, the second woman that she speaks to, and she says, I don't just want this to be words on paper. I want the whole world to understand what we're going through. There's a whole generation that's been lost here. You know, that wasn't scripted. That was her speaking from the heart. There's a scene afterwards in a hospital where a man brings in his son after a mortar attack. I spent weeks interviewing different people to play that role. And this guy was also from Homs. He was at a protest, and his two-year-old nephew was shot by a sniper and bled out in front of him.
Oh, my gosh.
And so the trauma and the grief that he brought into that room onto set was so immense and almost unbearable. At one point, Rosamund walked off the set and was like, you know, what are we doing? The lines between documentary and fiction are so blurry. I've never really experienced anything like this. You know, is this okay? And I said, yes. You know, this is something I deal with on a daily basis in my documentaries is, you know, you have this human instinct to want to give someone a hug or to give them space, but your job is to capture these moments, as it was for Marie.
So why did you decide to make a feature film and not a documentary?
The types of documentaries that I make are present day, sort of verite, following life as it unfolds before you type of films. And she's dead. So that wasn't an option. Mm-hmm. I probably would have loved to make a documentary about her if she were still alive. She'd probably be in Idlib in Syria right now, or Yemen, or that's something I actually think about a lot, is where would she be and what would she be saying about the state of journalism and the state of the world today?
Well, there's a very depressing card at the end of the movie that says, since she died in 2012, 500,000 Syrian civilians or Syrians have been killed. And it just made me think of the futility of it, of covering that, of the futility of her losing her life. And still, in that interview with Anderson Cooper, she's like, where is the world? Nobody cares. Nobody's paying attention. This was a desperate cry for people to care. And yet, we see what we see in Syria. I'm just wondering what you think of that. I mean, do you ever feel like it's not worth it?
Oh, I think if I started to feel like it's not worth it, then I'd probably stop doing what I'm doing. Obviously, I think it's worth it. I'll never forget, I made a documentary right before this about Syria, about a group of activists from Raqqa, the capital of the Islamic State, who rose up to expose the atrocities of ISIS. And right before the film premiered at Sundance, there's an image of a boy in Aleppo in the back of an ambulance covered in dust. It went all over the internet, went all over the world. And so many people came up to me and said, you know, can you believe what happened in Syria today? And I said, yeah, can you believe what's happening in Syria every single day for the past 5 years? My job is to at least show people a window into a world that they might not otherwise get to see.
For what end, though? I mean, as an audience member seeing that, what do you want me to come away with?
Well, obviously, I don't think you're going to be able to fix the crisis in Syria. Or maybe you can, and if you can, then maybe you shouldn't be sitting where you are. Or maybe you should be running for office or doing something else. Can you fix it?
I wish I could.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean,
it kind of goes to the heart of journalism, period. I mean, this question, does it matter? Does it matter that people know what's happening in Syria if 500,000 people are killed?
I obviously think, of course, it matters. And I think it's important to understand what's happening in this world. I think it's important to vote and to elect people in office to make decisions about things that do affect people in Syria. And I think what's scary is, you know, it's hard to decipher between fact and fiction. You know, the world of journalism has changed a lot since Marie died and since Marie started as a journalist. You know, when she started, traditional dangers of being a journalist were being shot at or getting hit by a mortar attack or the dangers of being in a war zone. The idea of being targeted wasn't really in the sort of lexicon of what could happen per se. You know, there's a scene in the movie before she loses her eye in Sri Lanka in which, you know, she stands up and says, "I'm a journalist, American, don't shoot." And she gets hit by an RPG and loses her eye. You know, so she thought, as many people thought at that time, that, you know, being a journalist gave you a semblance of protection. And that's obviously no longer the case. And we've obviously tragically seen that most recently with the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and many other Western journalists over the past couple of years since she was killed.
Did you ever worry about that fact and fiction blurring making this movie? Because you are committed to journalism, did you ever worry, oh my gosh, here I am making a feature film, I'm doing the very thing that I worry about?
No, because I tried to make it as authentic and truthful as possible. Obviously, there are things that I had to compress time-wise, or, you know, there's some characters that are composite characters based on real people. But the essence of who she was and the essence of what she stood for and the essence of what she fought for and the places that she went to were things that were absolutely imperative for me to get right.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today. Thank you for your movie.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Matthew Heineman, director of A Private War. Coming up, the secret to a long and happy marriage, according to Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and now, a love story.
It's really good to see you, Ron.
You've aged horribly.
You son of a bitch.
That didn't take long.
Oh, my God! What is your problem? Nothing's changed, has it? Who set the bed on fire, huh?
Excuse me.
I did, okay? Is that what you want to
hear? We're fine. We're fine.
Please. Sorry. Oh, take it easy.
That, of course, is Tammy and Ron, fictional characters from the NBC comedy series Parks and Rec, played by Megan Mullally and Nick Offerman. They, on the show, are twice divorced in real life. They're actually married and deeply in love, and now they're telling us all about it in a new book called The Greatest Love Story Ever Told, and they're here now. Hi, you guys.
Hello.
Hi.
That was a pretty funny bit.
That was funny. That made me laugh.
That was good fun.
Forgot about that one. Yeah, most people are just starting to figure out that we're even dating, much less that we've been together for 18 years and are married.
18 years, that is quite a bit.
Yeah.
It is. In Hollywood marriage years, it's like 117.
It's a bushel of years.
Yeah. A bushel of years. So why do we need to know how happily married you are?
Well, we don't. But when we started on social media, it was just a really weird thing because every time we posted anything that had to do with Nick and I together in the same photo, people went bonkers. And we started thinking, maybe we should
like bonkers in the way that they wanted to be like
they,
you?
Yeah, they wanted more. And that also made us think, it was as if our relationship was becoming mythologized. And so hence the title, The Greatest Love Story Ever Told.
Very tongue-in-cheek. Why do you think people are so interested?
I think because we have the good fortune of both playing characters that people really have taken to on Will and Grace and Parks and Recreation, and then to find out that we get along, you know, that we have a healthy, happy marriage, just seems really unlikely. All of those ingredients aren't supposed to work together. For me, it's kind of pleasurable to communicate how, you know, our secret is sort of banal normalcy. Mm-hmm. People make a big deal because we're visible on TV about a relationship, and we say, well, we actually are just very boring and we communicate well, and that seems to be the key.
Are you two opposites, pretty much?
Yeah. I mean, well, okay, no. Yes and no, because we're opposite in our temperaments, I suppose, but we're very similar in our worldview. Mm-hmm. And our tastes. So we're almost exactly the same. We almost never disagree on a movie or a book or a television show or a piece of art or, you know, the status of another couple we know's marriage or anything like that. But then temperamentally, Nick is much more even-keeled and I'm just really cute.
But you both came from the Midwest, but you grew up, as you describe it, in a very Norman Rockwell family. You did not.
Mm-mm.
You had a volatile upbringing.
Yeah. My house was more like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or something.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know which character I played, but it wasn't as tranquil as one might have hoped. My father was, you know, I hadn't talked about my father at all for my entire life until just the last year or so. And he's not around to defend himself, but he was unquestionably a really terrible alcoholic. And, you know, he was a really bad womanizer. And that was like a big thing around our house because I would be recruited to be the assistant detective sometimes because my mom was upset. I mean, understandably, and she, you know, wanted to get to the bottom of things. But it was a constant. There was a lot to get to the bottom of because
so
he was very busy.
You had to, like, catch him or do you have to,
I had to help her figure out who he was talking to on the phone and, like, go through the glove box in the car and find letters to and from different people. And so that wasn't the most amazing. But he just, the main problem was his rage. So he had misophonia, so he didn't like the sound of chewing. So sometimes at the dinner table, there'd be like a sudden, misophonia is a thing where certain people are, you're sensitive to certain sounds. I actually have inherited it to a degree. I don't like to be in loud places for extended periods of time, but I guess most people probably don't.
When we're home, I have to eat out of doors.
He has to sit in his car.
But
to
I
eat.
Like it out there. I mean, we get along.
Like, that car is air conditioned. You got radio. No. I mean, what,
yeah,
do
what
you
more
want?
Do you want, really?
And yeah, so he had those things. So it was a little scary because I didn't know, like, I couldn't really seem to do anything right. And so that part of my upbringing, I feel like I've triumphed over a lot of things.
But not a great model for a good marriage.
No, it was not a good model for, it wasn't a good role model for a marriage. So I got so lucky because Nick's parents are just the opposite.
They are.
They're like together and.
Yeah, they're, I mean.
Loving and supportive and all that.
They are. They're just honest, decent, hardworking Midwesterners.
And they're really cute together. They're really loving with each other. His dad's always talking about how pretty his mom is and they're always holding hands and
you guys are holding hands right now.
We are. We have a habit of holding hands. We always, I was thinking about that last night when we were watching television. We always hold hands when we're together. I would say, like, there's no television show or movie or anything that we haven't held hands through the entire, or had, like, significant body parts touching. Well, not, I don't mean that. I mean.
Well, that's happened. I like this gig, Madeline, and I, you know, in case Megan gets an idea that if she comes to her senses and realizes she could do better, I want to have a grip on her.
Like a physical grip.
Yes, in case she thinks about escaping. I'd like to keep
her
by my side.
You could just tie her up, I guess.
I could, but that, I think, would be untoward. I think that's crossing a line.
That would be a little untoward. I don't know, or maybe not. I don't know. I don't know the secrets of your marriage.
I keep my shackles emotional.
Well, so how? So you are at this, you know, kind of peak of your careers. Not saying that it's downhill from now, but you're at the in the mix of it. You guys are both big celebrities. So how do you keep that away from the marriage?
Well, that's kind of at the root of it. I feel like we treat that, you know, like work, and you
sort of. Well, it really is. I mean, it really is just a public service that we're providing.
Yeah.
The public service of entertainment.
And so we keep it out of the house. There's nothing in the house.
You would never guess what we do for a job. Yeah.
There's no.
There are no Emmys everywhere.
There's a closet in the guest room full of Megan's accolades. And I have like one certificate in there from the Future Farmers of America. best soybean crop.
Did you have animals growing up?
My mom's family had pigs, and her two brothers still farm corn and soybeans. So it was mainly a grain farm and still is, but I grew up working on their farm and around the pig farm as well.
I had a poodle and a cat.
It's the same.
Very similar.
Yeah. And they were delicious.
Well, what do you know about pigs that we should know?
I don't know. They're very smart. They are often...
I fear them for that.
Quite personable. Sure, they could take over. I would watch
a rural farm. I've read it. I know what they're up to.
Yeah.
Is that where you learned the woodworking skills?
My whole family, it was very, in hindsight, very little house on the prairie. Like my nuclear family, but also my extended family, particularly my mom's siblings, they're all public servants. There's the farming contingent, but then there are school teachers, librarians, paramedics, and others. So everybody used tools in one way or another. Everybody sort of fabricated their livelihoods. So I grew up with the use of tools as part of my education, as how one makes a fruitful life. And my dad was an amateur furniture maker. He was a very skilled carpenter. So we built things together around our house. We built a little barn together. And so naturally then, when I needed to get a job as a teenager for college, I started framing houses. So I naturally became a carpenter. And only then, when I moved to Los Angeles, did I fully shift into fine woodworking. It's sort of a lifelong obsession. I continue to refine my work and will, you know, hope to do so until my hands give up.
That's so...
Yeah, totally different. I think I was an only child, and so since it wasn't loads of, you know, a barrel of laughs at my house, I would go into my room and I would shut the door and put a record on the record player and make up some very dramatic dance to some song, and I'd perfect it, and then I'd have my mom come in and watch it. And then I also believed in elves and fairies, and I would want my friends around the neighborhood to play elves and fairies with me.
Did they comply?
They tried to comply, but they'd be like, I don't get it. Like, we're just sitting in a room. There's nothing here. And I'd be like, no, you don't get it. Get out. And then what else did I knew every song on the radio. I did a lot of singing. I was always singing. I was just always really, I guess, I read a lot. I loved to go to the library. That was my very favorite activity, was to go to the library, check out 11 books, and then lay on the floor of my bedroom and read them all. or I used to like to draw. I mean, the bottom line is I was always wanting to do something creative.
Mm-hmm. You've just almost perfectly described how you still spend every possible day that
That's
you can.
That's true.
You've always,
in your room by yourself?
Always with
pretending to be a fairy?
A stack of 11 books. She reads voraciously. She's constantly reading.
It's a pathological.
And also, this is a good time for a plug. If you go to nancyandbeth.com, which is Megan's band, Nancy and Beth, you'll see her performing dramatic choreography to songs. It's still exactly the same.
There are a few music videos that I've directed on that site. But no, I do like doing all of those things.
But I didn't know you were in a band.
Yeah, I have a band called Nancy and Beth, and it's very, very important to me, the band. It's me and a young musician and actress named Stephanie Hunt, who's 30 years younger than me. And then I. And KCRW. Don't want to do it wrong. We sing in harmony. We have five pieces behind us. Everybody in the band sings. Every song is choreographed from top to bottom. We wear matching costumes.
And do you sing?
I sing, yes. I sing the melodies, and Stephanie sings the harmonies with me, and we do everything together. It's kind of a twinning moment. We're very much in sync, kind of like Nick and I. We're very much in sync and have the
Nick.
Same ethos.
I had a good run.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
Hold on to that hand.
If it goes that way, it's going to be understandable.
Stephanie does not have the kind of ability to grow facial hair at an alarming rate that Nick has.
I will say the beard you're sporting right now is a healthy beard.
He grew it in like
a week. I appreciate it. I come by it honest. You know, I have never done anything to foment any of my follicular health, but it persists nonetheless.
You also seem to be quite the wordsmith, just listening to you speak.
Well,
follicular health is pretty good.
He doesn't talk like that
at home. He only does that during interviews.
How do you talk at home?
Very monosyllabic.
Like, I like cake.
Honey, meat. Now.
So when you first met, it was not a mutual attraction.
Well,
it wasn't mutual.
I mean, I feel like
it was one-sided, pretty much.
I feel like when we met,
First of all, how was your follicular health when you were meeting?
It was there. Yeah. It was in place. Yeah,
it's always been there. It'll always be there.
When we first met, it took me some time. I didn't consider us
30 seconds
two equal human beings. You know, I really felt well beneath Megan.
Because she was already established?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was a broke jerk living in somebody's basement. And I was happy, and I had a very healthy theater career. But Megan, you know, I had not met people that were on a hit TV show. And when she walked into the first day of rehearsal, she was incredibly turned.
For a play, by the way.
Yeah, for a play in Los Angeles in the year 2000. And she had this incredibly curated, cute outfit. And then she proceeded to, you know, to render the first read-through of the play with the brilliance that we've come to know that she has. And so I just was, I was gobsmacked. I was like, well, it didn't occur to me, oh, what an attractive person. It was more like, oh, my God, I feel like I'm in a play with Julie Andrews meets, you know, Bernadette Peters meets, you know, Katharine Hepburn or something.
So how did you think that you stood a chance with that?
It took me a while to occur to me that I might stand a chance. And the way it happened was we made friends. We became friends backstage.
We were cracking each other up a lot.
Yeah.
And I thought he was really funny.
You know, and then we grew a little closer. We formed a sort of confederacy. We were the only two people that didn't know everybody else in this big cast. So we were the two outsiders. And then she quietly sang this Victorian dirge called In the Gloaming into my ear one day, and that I was that was pretty much it. I was like, okay.
And when was it for you?
Do with me what you will.
I think it was one day when we were rehearsing a scene that Nick and I were both in together, and the theater was in this old factory. It was an old bra factory, ironically.
Sexy.
Since Nick loves bras. He's wearing one right now. Wow. but not where you'd think. and the sun was streaming through those big, giant, old, you know, almost floor-to-ceiling windows. And he just did something that made me laugh so hard. And I thought, God, that guy is so funny. Wait a minute. Is he sexy and cute? Like, could this be happening? Because, and the reason was, I don't think it's because he's not sexy and cute, because obviously he is. I think it was because I had just never dated a guy who was really manly. I had dated these very skinny, androgynous, hairless, sort of rock drummery, basically gay guys is what I had dated. Mm-hmm. And then this, I was like, what is this? What is it? I didn't even know. I had no guidelines. I mean, I'd seen Tarzan, but that was about it.
There are lots of pictures of you two with your jigsaw puzzles in various outfits.
Yeah, I know. So we have a little
risque.
We have a monkey on our back with the jigsaw puzzles, and we do them. We try to pick like the sort of dumbest puzzles we can find, and we listen to audiobooks while we're assembling them. And then once we've finished, I run up into my closet, which is now called the costume shop, and I'll bring a bunch of stuff down, and then I'll dress Nick up. We did a whole series of puzzle, like fantasy puzzles of like ladies, like with long black hair,
like riding
in the moonlight with a stallion in a long red dress. So we did a whole series of those where Nick had to be dressed like the lady, basically, and he got progressively more ladylike as it went along, and I got progressively more disconcerted.
Nick, you're being manipulated by the puzzle.
Sure.
He's very easily influenced.
I mean, that there is a witchy member in our marriage, and I am under her spell.
Sounds like you're okay with that.
It's good fun.
The book is called The Greatest Love Story Ever Told. Megan Mullally, Nick Offerman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for our special New Year's Day 2019 edition of Press Play. Have a fantastic New Year's. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.